The following was a live storytelling event held on September 20th, 2014 in the Yaw Chapel of the SJ campus. The Greater Sitka Arts Council, partnering with Art Change, present Poor Choices Turned Good.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Sarah, and I'm the director of the Greater Sitka Arts Council. And I just want to thank you all for being here today. And thank you to the musicians and the storytellers and to Ellen for being such a great collaborator. We've had a lot of fun getting together with the storytellers and workshopping ideas and putting this event together. So I'm really happy to bring this to you. And what else? Oh, so before I forget, we do have a sign up over here if you want to be on our mailing list. And if you have any ideas for future storytelling events, we'd really love to hear about it.
And you can also sign up under the odd and let us know if you want to be a storyteller in a future event.
Oh, yeah. We're looking for more storytellers, so make sure you let us know. We want to do this again. We're thinking probably February-ish.
We're thinking less is more.
So you got a lot of time. Yeah, right? You got a lot of time to think about it. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it, except we will divulge to you that our first storyteller was unable to make it due to a broken ankle.
Which I heard at midnight last night.
Yeah. Yes. So yes. Now what's happening is Ellen and I are flipping a coin, and whoever loses is telling a story.
But before we do that, I want to thank, I'm glad this is happening, because I know I used to do this with Elise. It was kind of her baby. And so she left town to do more storytelling. So Sarah started emailing me, and then I ran into her in the post office, and I said, well, I have the idea for the... You can blame the first theme on me. I said, bad choices. And
I said, yeah.
And because I'm always really interested in narratives that aren't tidy, and that, you know, it's nice to know that everything gallops off in the sunset, and you meet your love on top of a skyscraper, and you live happily ever after. But I realize stories are way more complex, and I like narratives that are just untidy. So I really appreciate everyone for being really vulnerable, and because it's really vulnerable to do this. And we've had these discussions about, like, you know, when you tell a friend a story, it changes your relationship to your friends. And in a community, when you get to hear stories you didn't know, it really shapes the community.
Yeah.
So I was really bummed to find out that Satara could not join us to tell her story, and I'm really nervous about this flipping because
it's in the lap of the gods.
Okay.
You ready? Jessica's going to do it for us. Yep.
Oh, you have to call it.
Oh, you have to pull again.
Okay.
What are you calling?
Tails.
Yep. And does that mean tails you tell the story or tails you don't?
Tails I don't have to tell it.
Heads.
So, does that mean she tells it?
No.
That means I tell it.
Okay. One more thing. One rule is that the organizers are supposed to get up and once in a while tell a story, but I'm chicken, so you get that.
Are you going to introduce me, though, Ellen?
Sorry about that.
I'm so excited not have to be up.
Oh, I know. Okay. Wait, let me gather my thoughts. Okay.
Sarah's telling a story because she lost the coin toss with me. Her husband says it's karma. Sarah says life begins where your comfort zone ends. And Sarah's story is called Gray Area. Thank you.
Okay. This story begins in New Mexico. So I'm living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this is a desert plateau. And I don't know how many of you have been to Albuquerque, but it is at the confluence of two major interstates. So there are all manner of vagabonds, travelers, drifters. It's a strange place, I found. A good place, but strange. So I'm living in Albuquerque, and I am working at a restaurant. It's called Jamaica Jamaica, and it's Jamaican food. And these Jamaicans are fresh from Jamaica, so it's the real deal. And I'm working at Jamaica Jamaica. I'm not making very much money at all. It turns out New Mexico is the only state where your tips are counted in as part of your wage. So I was actually getting paid about $3.75 an hour. And then, you know, you get your tips on top of that. So it was a very lean time for me. I'm working there, and one day a man comes to work there, a young man. And his name is Fido, he tells me. I'm Fido, okay? And we kind of slowly start to get to know each other. And Fido tells me that he had come into money. His dad had died in an accident, and he had come into a bunch of money. And with that money, he had been partying and had came up with the name Fido. It was DJ Fido. So this is one of his identities that he had prior to working at Jamaica Jamaica. He was DJ Fido. So, you know, we get to know each other better and better just through being coworkers. And it slowly comes to light that Fido is actually a heroin addict. And I sort of piece this together. I just figure it out. He goes into the bathroom a lot, and he comes out, and his pupils are just teeny tiny. The man never eats. And I just, you know, started to realize something was up with Fido. But we continued to be friends. And eventually we got to be good enough friends to where I could ask him about it. And so I did. I asked him, how can you do this? What about your family? Where are the people who love you? Why are you making these choices with your life? I felt free enough to ask him all of those things. And he just said, yeah, Sarah, it's better than anything. It's better than love. It's better than sex. It's better. So, knowing Fido this way and continuing to work with him, little details about Fido that will help paint a little picture of him. He's working two jobs. He's a server in both of these jobs. He owns one outfit. He has one pair of black pants and one white shirt, and he has one pair of shoes. And I see the bottom of his shoes one day, and they're worn all the way through to his socks. He makes enough money each day so that he can pay for his hotel room and then get his fix that he needs. So this is all pretty new to me. At least, you know, so I'm trying to overcome a lot of prejudices that I have, thinking that people who are addicted to heroin just are living under bridges. But no, this person is, you know, a functioning, working human being. So I'm just kind of wrestling with that. And we remain friends, and my time in New Mexico is drawing to a close, and I'm sort of getting ready to leave. And I get a knock on my door, my little apartment one day, you know, all those little adobe buildings that are in New Mexico. So I'm in one of those, and the rent is very, very cheap there. I get a knock on the door, and it's Fido, and he needs to borrow money. So you know, he gives me a big spiel, and I need money, and I'm going to get sick, and I have nowhere else to go, and I have no one else to trust, and I need you to give me money. And so I said, okay, I'm going to think about that for a little while. And we set up a meeting place, and I said if I was there, I would loan him the money, and if not, I couldn't do it. So I thought about it for a long time, and I wrestled with it. Just all kinds of things. I mean, am I condoning his lifestyle by giving him this money? Is it really my place to even judge? Who am I to say, you know, how he should live his life? He's hurting. He's obviously needs compassion at this time. So what should I do? So I decide I'm going to give him the money. 5 minutes. Okay, I'm almost there. I'm going to give him the money. So I go and I meet him and I give him the money. And, you know, I'll pay you back tomorrow, Sarah. And okay. The next day comes, he doesn't pay me back. In fact, I don't see him for days and days and days. And by this time, I've stopped working at Jamaica Jamaica because I'm getting ready to head back to Alaska. So I don't see him, and it is the last day that I am in New Mexico. I've got everything in boxes. I'm all wrapped up and ready to go. And I think, well, maybe I'll just stop by Jamaica Jamaica and like say bye and see if he's there, and, you know, I don't want to make him feel bad or anything, but I'm just going to see, you know, stop by and see. And So I lock the door and I turn around and there he is. And he hands me the money. And he gave me a hug and walked away. And that was it. And I wanted to share that story because that was about making decisions where there's just gray area and no clear right or wrong. And I still don't really know if that was a good or a bad choice. But that's my story. Ah, man, am I glad that's over. Okay, up next we have Owen. Owen Kindig is the luckiest man in the world. He's lucky to live in Sitka. He's lucky to work at UAS. He's lucky to be married to Beth. He's lucky to have four daughters who look like his wife. And he's lucky to have eight grandchildren. And he's luckier than this poor audience who has to listen to his poor choice story. Owen's story is called, My Wife Said You Can't Trust Him.
Yeah, it's true. I am the luckiest man in the world. I've been hit 3 times from behind on my bike without having an significant injury. I've been lucky in love. My wife and I have been married for 41 years. And, well, I've been happily married 41 years. this story is... one of those stories that it's kind of like one of the few events in my life that I remember where I was when. You know, Kennedy, Martin Luther King, 9/11, and the day I did the really bad deal. It started back in 1991 when The critical day was in 1991, and we had been married for 18 years. We lived in Newark, Ohio. We had a place in the country, rolling hills, a pond, four daughters, 40 sheep. Our house was cut into a hillside, and we had a walkout basement that we called the mudroom. And as I was preparing to leave to go do what I thought I had to do, Beth was standing there with her shovel in the mudroom. And had we talked about it? Yes. Had we agreed? No. But I thought I needed to do this deal. I thought I needed to sell my video business to an employee who was our VP of production. So... 10 years prior, we had started the business, and it had started, you know, with Beth and I working together, doing printing and slides and slideshows, and the slide business kind of took off. And in 5 years, we had a dozen employees and had moved into a kind of a loft, cool kind of a loft space near downtown Columbus, and. We, in many ways, were successful. We had, you know, clients like Nestle and Owens Illinois and McGraw-Hill. But we weren't losing money, but we weren't really profitable either. And so I hired a behavioral psychologist to try to help me qualify a production manager. And Beth thought that was a waste of money, and who knows, I suppose you could say why. Well, maybe one reason was because the first guy that the guy qualified was a complete disaster and was gone in 2 weeks. The second guy was even more bizarre, and we were, when I fired him, he ended up taking one of our corporate credit cards and went on a spending spree in Lebanon, the country. And so... but, you know, over the years, I've always been, I've often been wrong, but I've rarely been uncertain. So we went ahead with the third candidate that this guy came up with. And it was a guy who I'll call Mac from Chicago. And we, at first he seemed to really be doing well. For 2 years almost, he did the day-to-day, he wrote the checks, worked with my controller. I was blissfully happy just doing creative output for our clients. And then one day, and we thought at that point that we were going to have $1 million sales year that year. At that point, my controller came to me and said, you know, I don't trust Mac anymore. And I said, why? What's wrong? And she said, well, we have a $40,000 sales tax bill that we're delinquent on, and tomorrow they're going to hit us with a $20,000 penalty. Mm-hmm. Whose fault was it? Well, there was fiduciary responsibility on the part of Mac and my controller, but ultimately, the bottom line, it was my fault. Or not, at least my responsibility, and so I that brought us to what were we going to do? We went to a lawyer. He said, you know, you've got door B, bankruptcy; door A, restructure the business and pay everybody off. So we met as a family. We talked about it. The girls and Beth and I, we agreed that we would go through door A. We would pay everyone off, and we would just curtail our expenses drastically. So that's what we started to do, but we had to restructure the business. And so I had the brilliant idea, oh, we'll break it in half and I'll sell the video half of the business to Mac. And he was excited. He could get family money. He could buy our equipment. He could pay me commissions for work that he did with the clients and so forth. And so we structured a deal, he agreed to the deal, and then his lawyer drafted it, and that was a dumb idea because there was no teeth in it to hold him accountable, but I was held to a 2-year non-compete. So the whole thing hinged on whether we could trust Mac, the knife, and it turned out not so well. I guess we're out of time. So bottom line, what did I learn? After 6 months of self-pity, I found my footing again and started moving forward. Gradually, the debt started melting away. I was facing a mountain of $240,000 in debt, and it took 7 years. But, one day at a time, one $50 payment at a time, my creditors began to respect me. My clients began to come back. I began to respect myself. And what were the positives? I think that there were a lot of them, but they were all intangible. They were character lessons that I learned. One of them was that, I forgot what I was going to say about that. Anyway, bottom line, but my biggest takeaway was that, I wanted to mention that I had, when we had a lot of good clients and employees in the future once I paid everything off, and one of those employees turned out to became my son-in-law. So I have an Ohio son-in-law as a result of that. But the biggest lesson that I learned, the biggest takeaway was always listen to your wife. especially when she's got a shovel.
Okay, next up is Jessica. One more story and then take a little break. And we're going to go from losing money to losing teeth. And what's really fun about organizing this is having that spectrum of where we are in our life and the choices we get to make, good, bad, and poor. So let me introduce Jessica, and then I'll wire her up. But Jessica, I was really excited when my phone rang, and it was from Grinnell, Iowa. I mean, right? Grinnell? Yes. So I said, oh, cool. So Jessica is from a small town in Iowa and loves the Midwest. Though Jessica has only been here for a few weeks, she has fallen in love with Sitka. Her favorite things are adventures and puns. Jessica's story is called Shattered Smile. Okay. Let's, oh, you got your coat. Let's put this here.
Have you ever had the dream that your teeth are falling out? Okay, I really hate that dream. And one morning I woke up and it wasn't a dream. I had actually knocked out my two front teeth. So I'm laying in bed and I'm remembering how it happened. And I had been at a party, a college party, and I had fallen and I had broken my two front teeth in half at these really disgusting angles. And so I'm laying there in bed and I'm remembering the night. And I had been so upset that none of my friends could console me. They were all saying, oh, it's okay, they're just teeth. And I said, no. My teeth are very important, and these are the most important ones right in the front. And I was very upset. And so I asked my friends to stay with me. So my friend Christina had stayed the night. And so we were sharing our, you know, tiny dorm room bed. And so I scooched out the bottom of the bed early in the morning to go look in the mirror because I was really hoping that it had just been a dream. Well, I look in the mirror and I open my mouth in sort of this sneer because at this moment in my life it was completely impossible to smile. And I look in the mirror and it wasn't a dream. Have you ever seen a wall that someone didn't want someone else to climb over? So instead of putting barbed wire up there, they put up sharp rocks and broken glass bottles. That's what my mouth looked like, this really jagged mess. And I didn't really know what to do about it, so I went back to bed. And I said, Christina, will you please tell me those stories again? Because the only thing that could not make me feel better but make me feel less awful was to hear about all the different people that she knew that had also knocked out their teeth. So I'm laying there, and she's telling me these stories, and I'm closing my eyes, and I'm imagining this guy that she met at summer camp that had knocked out one front tooth and had decided to leave it there, left it, you know, just this hole in his mouth all summer. And I'm picturing him, like, kayaking and smiling with, like, missing a tooth. And I just can't imagine living a life without a tooth because I'm caring a lot about my teeth right now. And I finally fall back asleep, and then in a more reasonable hour of the morning, we wake up, and I start thinking about, what am I going to do now? And it's a Sunday, so I can't go get my teeth fixed. So I have to go through this whole day toothless. And luckily, I had a lot of friends to help me along the way. And so we did things like go to the pharmacy to get some pain meds, go to the grocery store to buy some soup, go tell my softball coach what happened. And one of the hardest ones, call my parents. Yeah. They were very upset, you know, because I had years of braces. But they decided we couldn't leave my mouth like that, even to teach me a lesson, because how would I give any presentations in class? How would I ever eat or talk or go to a job interview? And so they agreed that I should call my dentist. So I called up my dentist at home, and I had to leave this really embarrassing message on his home answering machine asking him, can you please help me tomorrow morning? And so it was a long, toothless day, and it was also wintertime, so going outside with exposed teeth was not pretty. But in the morning, I woke up really early, and I really didn't have any hope that my teeth would be fixed because I had really had this idea that I had perfect teeth and they would never look the same. And I was really afraid that, you know, my life was just falling apart. But I went to the dentist with all these pictures of my perfect teeth. And he just put it into his hands and was like, please help me. And, you know, I have teeth now. You can all see. And I was really grateful for my friends and family because, like my teeth, I had really strong roots that I could rebuild upon. And I, similar to my teeth, may have been broken up a little. And I definitely wasn't smiling for a while. But I was still alive.
Awesome. Cool. Okay. So Steve's about to change it up on us a little bit, I think.
Am I?
I think you just, you're okay. Trying to do that shifty thing there. Okay. So Steve was born, in case you can't tell from his accent there, but I have an accent too, was born in New Zealand and has lived in Sitka for 40 years. He is an artist and a commercial fisherman, though sometimes he tells me he's not fishing and then I hear he's fishing again. Steve's story is called From Art School to This.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not a storyteller like the previous three folks, but, and the other thing I want to preface this with is I can look around here and see stories. Obviously, everybody's got a story. So mine's just a little story. It's about how I ended up here in this place and it, what seemed like a pretty, maybe a bad choice and sort of a scary choice turned into being here with you guys. So 40-some years later, took a while. But so I was born in New Zealand and went to art school. I was going to be an artist. And then my parents pointed out that, you know, it's pretty hard to make a living doing that, as it turns out. And they were right. And so I decided to be an art teacher. So I had to go to art school, and which I did. I got, I'll blow my own trumpet, I did really good. You know, I got a scholarship and off I went to art school for 1 year. And then my future brothers-in-law were in New Zealand, and they were down the South Island deer hunting. Now, in New Zealand, you can hunt deer for money, commercially, like we catch our fish here. So, and there were buyers everywhere. It was a business. Well, they passed through Auckland, where I was going to school, and they said, you know, what the heck are you doing at this? Look at this big city. Why are you at this school? You should come with us. So I quit art school, for crying out loud. I'd worked really hard to get there and went deer hunting with these guys. Now, I've never killed anything. I don't know anything about deer hunting. I'm not saying I do now, but because we did this for 3 or 4 years. You know, this was a lot of work. Anyway, so I had to get a rifle. So off we went down the South Island of New Zealand. And so I went to a second-hand shop. You could actually still buy a rifle through a second-hand shop then. So I bought a 7.65mm rifle, wooden stock, open sights. I don't even know what I'm doing with this thing. And we go down the west coast of the South Island and start hunting deer. And I wouldn't change it for anything. But it seemed like my parents, you know, were a little not happy about this choice. So, they got used to the idea. So, we lived in a cabin out in the woods and shot deer for a few years and sold them. And I was young. It was physically demanding. The only thing we owned was our tennis runners, which was what we called them, our tennis shoes, our rifles, the clothes on your back, and we had this old car that we used to deliver the deer in to the buyers. It was I'm telling you, I wish my kids, the nearest thing to it is commercial fishing now. It is, but just we just didn't know any better, you know. All we did was work hard all the time and make this little bit of money selling this venison. It was a lot of fun. I wouldn't trade it for art school. I could be an art teacher, you know. Anyway, the good thing I feel like, the point of the story is that I made this choice, I ditched this potential career. And I don't think I would be as adventuresome, if that's what I am, now, if I had done that. I'm a commercial fisherman. It's, you know, it's a little shaky business at times. I've got two boys that are in it. I've got a son-in-law that's in it. It's and I'm glad. I'd rather see some risk involved. I don't think I would have taken those risks if I hadn't gone and done this deer hunting. And it was quite a lark. I could tell you a lot of stories about that. One short one, since I haven't seen the signal yet. For example, where we hunted, there were 14 helicopters working. 14. It was like being in a war zone. We were foot shooting. So we'd go out every day, hunt the bush, shoot a deer if you could find one, carry it out and sell it. These guys are shooting from the helicopters. Now, this is during the Vietnam War era. So what we were getting in New Zealand was all the young American pilots were going from shooting whatever from a helicopter in Vietnam to coming down there and shooting deer, which didn't shoot back at them. And so it was a crazy time. Helicopters everywhere. When you're in the woods, there's choppers going over, boom, 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 boom. They use Browning semi-automatics, you know. It wasn't, anyway. It was quite the thing. There was just so, it was such a change from art school and a little bit risky. And it worked out. I came to Sitka. I feel so lucky to be here. I go back and forth, you know. But there is no other place like it. And I wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for that. So, and all four of my kids are here. Sarah's the oldest. Oh, thank you. I got a minute. So anyway, that I'd wrap it up there. But I guess the point is that I dumped this career, took a chance, and for me it worked out. Of course, you know, I don't have much now or anything. Of course, you don't have your paid retirement and all that stuff. You've got to take care of yourself as a fisherman, but it's okay. So anyway, that's my little story. So.
Rains from the high desert of northern New Mexico, where he dried out for a while before the birds brought him to the Pacific Northwest. They tried to drop him in Puget Sound, but he held on for the better part of 1,000 miles before he finally let go in Sitka. Zach's story is called Looking for Transformation? I Discover I Want Water and a Burrito. Yeah.
I'm laying on my belly, peering over the edge of a 600-foot cliff in the middle of the desert of northern New Mexico. I can feel the sun on my neck. The sun is beating there, but just barely, because of the dust and the sweat that has been caked there and everywhere else on my body for the last 72 hours. I'm also on my belly because I haven't eaten in 3 days, and aside from the cliff, I'm feeling a little dizzy. Further precautions, I'm completely alone, and the only person who knows where I am for literally thousands of miles is Hugo, and I'm beginning to wonder if I should have ever trusted Hugo. It seemed like a good idea at the time. I came to the desert to find myself. I wanted to go hungry, cavort with the gods, transcend my ego, become enlightened, and to share my wisdom with the masses and be awesome, like Gandhi. I'd been on this self-transformation kick for a while. I had done the vegetarian thing and the vegan thing and the yoga thing and the Tai Chi and the insight meditation and the whirling dervishes and the hitchhiking and the mountain climbing and the composting and the farmers markets and college. All of it. But it was Hugo who had agreed with me that the one way to truly find yourself is to spend 3 days alone in the desert with nothing to eat. Now, I don't want to put it all on Hugo because that's not fair. I'd been having this dream for a while where this big, beautiful, magnificent bird plucked up all my things and then took them off to the desert. And after a quick internet search, I learned that this was an obvious meaning, that this dream obviously meant that I needed to go to New Mexico, get rid of all my worldly possessions, and destroy everything about my 22-year-old self that I reviled by fasting for 3 days and nights on the Taos Plateau in August. Seemed like a good idea at the time. So. Now, the funny thing was, I was on the edge of the desert. I was with Hugo. I was there. I was about to do it. And it was the night before I was set to go. And I was feeling a little bit of doubt, so I had a moment. I prayed to the gods of the desert. I said, gods of the desert, send me a sign. I don't know what I'm doing. And at that moment, I finished this prayer, and the bird from the dream flew over our heads into the sunset. And I was like, holy shit, Hugo, that is the bird from my dream. Dude, that's a sign. I got to do this tomorrow. And Hugo said, that's a turkey vulture. And I said, no, dude, the big brown one. That's the bird from my dream. And Hugo said, that's a turkey vulture. So the next morning I got up, I summoned my courage. And Hugo fed me my final meal of my tasteless, meatless, cheeseless, sugarless salad. And set me on my way with 3 gallons of water, these 2 leather hiking boots, and this stupid hat. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And needless to say, things started to go awry within about the first 6 hours. I was sitting there, which is what I had planned to do the whole time, sit there like Gandhi. And I don't know if you've ever done something for 6 hours that really bored you with the intent to do it for another 66 hours, but things can start to get a little grim, which is how, attempting to scale down the cliff to go play in the river, I lost my first water jug, barely drank, barely, still full, to its doom. Now, bringing the water jug along with me, you know the story at this point. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Yes, yes. The second day, I was especially glad I had my hat because it was one of the hottest days of the summer. And I had most of my water to myself, luckily. I still managed to spill a little bit when I took off my boots to do Tai Chi and I stepped on a cactus. Now, as you know, it seemed like, no, you're wrong. It was a stupid idea. I should have kept my boots on. The third day, it was the hottest day of the summer, and I finished all of my water by 2 p.m. And I wasn't as worried as you would think, because I was mostly just hungry and tired and dirty and dizzy, which is why I was on my belly over the cliff. The biggest storm I've ever seen started with one brisk wind, brisk enough to whip off the hat, out into space and down the way of the water jug. This was a tragic loss. I don't purport to know how Tom Hanks' character in Castaway felt when he lost Wilson, but I imagine it was something like that. And I was peering over the edge on my belly, looking to find if there was any way I could go get this damn hat. But I knew there was no way. My feet were sore, and I had spines in them, and this was pretty much over. There was no hat. There was no water. There was no transcendence. And I turned over, and I actually did. I started to tear up, and I looked up at the clouds, and I said out loud, "What am I doing here? Why did I think I could do this? Why am I trying to make this happen?" And against the clouds rolling in, I saw it, silhouetted, the stupid turkey vulture. And I actually started to cry, because this wasn't a sign at all, unless the sign was, "I look like dinner," which made me laugh, because that was funny, and because I really wanted dinner. And as I was laughing, the clouds cracked open, and I was pummeled by the classic midsummer southwestern monsoon. Now, for as many times as I cursed Hugo's name that weekend, when he came to pick me up the next morning at the cliffside, I was glad it was him, because he knew something I never could have known, because somehow, and I still don't know how this happened, in his left hand was my stupid hat, and in his right hand was the cheesiest, meatiest, most delicious burrito I've ever beheld. And I ate that burrito that morning. And folks, I can tell you now, today, that I know what transcendence tastes like.
Now, we got to workshop these, but you know, that was really fun. It's part of our process, but I had no idea of how things were going to come out in reality, and that was, it's really wonderful. I love the variety. So now, Robert has agreed to do one. Is there anyone else who would like to do an impromptu poor choice story? Is there anyone else? Okay. Okay. Jennifer.
Yeah.
Okay. So Robert only would tell me he was being really mysterious. It was something about his brother's bad choice. Okay. Okay, he's going to tell a story of someone else's bad choice. Okay. All right, let's put this in your...
Oh, okay, we'll put it in your pocket.
Okay. Oh, can I tell people anything that we should know about you?
I live in Sitka. Yeah. I'm actually a nurse here in town.
All right.
I need to tell you about my brother. My brother was a mess. He was full of bad choices. And I'm going to tell you just quickly one thing about Mr. Bad Choice that took me a while to learn. My mom died, Ma, and we all lived on a small farm. And Ma had a little inheritance. And when Ma died, he begged my father to give him part of that inheritance now. And my father finally agreed that, go, be gone. And we knew he was going to go do bad choices. He made bad choices in school, and he went off, and sure enough, he drank a good part of the money. He had a good time, but they were all bad choices. And I stayed with Dad, with Paul. And I knew my brother was out there making really, really bad choices. And we heard about those choices. We heard about the car wreck. We heard about the bad girlfriend who really made bad choices. We also heard, got the word that brother was so poor that he was working at the farm next to us. And he was too proud to come home. He was working, slopping pigs. Life wasn't good for him, but he was too proud to come home. And finally, Dad told me to go get him. And I went to see him, and he was dirty from his work. And he was just the epitome of bad choices. And I begged him to come home for Dad, and he refused. Another bad choice. So I went home, and I told Dad he refuses to come home. And Dad said, he'll come home. And sure enough, about a couple weeks later, he came home. And he was walking up the lane, and I couldn't believe it. Dad ran out to him and hugged him and loved him and brought him back to the house. And he took Dad's favorite coat and he put it around him. I made a bad choice. I made a choice to despise my brother, to hate him. And it took a long, long time for me to realize my bad choice was I didn't see that Dad loved us regardless.
Awesome. That was great. I have no idea what Jennifer's going
to
tell us.
It has to do with art schools. I'm feeding off the art school thing.
Okay.
But it's the other side of it. How many minutes do I have?
Maybe three.
Okay, I can do it. It's 1979. I'm in my second year of art and design high school in New York City, the high school that I had auditioned to get into, had left my zoned high school to avoid the drudgery of going to a regular high school so I could take art classes all day, and this was going to be the coolest thing I ever did. And my first period class, after trudging in on two buses and a subway every morning, my first period class is an advertising art class where I'm drawing Heinz ketchup bottles every day, every morning, the same way, for 5 months. And I don't know, maybe I'm fickle, but I wasn't feeling the love. It wasn't really working for me. My dream of going to an art high school, this is the sister school of FAME High School, you know, performing arts, music and art, all those schools. It wasn't working. And you combine that with my very low self-esteem, being 14, 15 years old, lots of experimental drug use. Okay, I'm kidding myself. It wasn't experimental at that point. It was serious recreational use, problems at home, probably being very depressed. And I decided that the teacher didn't like me, so I, in really just beautiful teenage wisdom, I stopped going to class. It was too early. It was the first class in the morning, and, you know, it was a big class. He wouldn't notice that I wasn't there, right? So I just stopped going regularly, and then I stopped going, like, at all. And somehow, and I really, my adult brain, I can't really figure out how I thought this was okay. I really thought this is all going to work out fine somehow, right? So in that time period that I'm skipping, these are double periods. The art school works on double periods, so you can actually have a good amount of time to work with your ketchup bottles. God even knows what I was doing. I was out, you know, roaming the streets of Manhattan, not even doing anything productive. Well, lo and behold, report cards come in December, and oh, guess what? I failed the class. Oh my God, like I didn't see that a million miles coming my way. My parents are horrified. I'm ashamed. I've never actually failed a class ever. And I don't even have a good explanation except something along the lines of, I think the teacher doesn't like me. It makes me uncomfortable to be there. Something that I failed to reconcile in 4.5 months. So with this, you know, I couldn't fail trig that I was struggling with. No, I failed art. That didn't make any sense. So it's the late 70s, and if you know anything about New York City in the late 70s, that was the period where Gerald Ford did the Drop Dead. We're in like total budgetary meltdown. There's no summer school for my school or many schools. So I have to make up this class. I'm like, why can't you just, you know, make it go away? This is my teenage brain. Well, what they did instead of summer school at my school was in summertime, they sent us to Parsons School of Design in the Village, and they had us take a life drawing class with adults, like actual grown-ups. So here I was being punished with summer school, coming into a classroom, and there were no ketchup bottles. There was a nude model and charcoal and as much paper as I needed and hours to draw. And what was supposed to be the punishment for my supreme screw-up, my total lack of maturity, ended up being the whetting of my appetite for what I really needed to do, which was set my sights past high school and into art school and getting my BFA. And that's what I did. Thank you.
What's your takeaway?
Everybody has a story, and you should sign up next time.
And I do have to say, if you happen to meet Miss Davis on just before Halloween, I'm going to be in Artisan Schools there, and the theme of that storytelling event is going to be freaking out. But you're not in Miss Davis. But we'll, in February, we'll do this again. So please, think about it. It's fun to make different people do it, and we really appreciate also our musicians.
The musicians. Yay!
Storytellers.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming.
Rachel for doing the sound, which it just may end up amazing. So thanks.
That was a live storytelling event brought to you by the Greater Sitka Arts Council and Art Change, recorded on September 20th, 2014, and you're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.